and welcome to Tech Weekly, the show that parses the rumors and extracts the reality from the vast pool of technology news that hits The Guardian's desks every week. I'm Alex Kratosky, and today we're digging around to find out more about the Conficker worm, the computer virus that threatened to destroy the world on April Fool's Day. Now, were we the fools, or will they have the last laugh? Ram Hirkanaidu from Kaspersky Lab dishes the dirt. Also,
when we talk about technology and women in technology, the temptation is to think about coding ninjas. And once you start to get away from the coding ninjas question, you start to see a lot more women in the application of technology. I think it appeals to women's sort of social side.
That was Sue Sharman-Anderson speaking on Tech Weekly a few weeks ago. Sophia Stewart, the director of mobile at Hearst Publishing, will be on call to comment on that. Charles, I imagine, and I don't know why this is, but I imagine that you live in a house that has a library with lovely mahogany shelves that are just covered in books, paper just falling off the shelves. Is that right?
It's a nice idea, but actually the books that fill the shelves are all kids' books at the moment. Obviously, I read them intensely.
Of course, backwards and forwards. Would you trade them for an e-book reader? I mean, would you trade that lovely
kids'
smell?
Books? You can't trade for an e-book reader. I mean, I don't know about the things that I read. You know, my wife and I went back a while ago, and we sort of did a fair clear out a lot of books. But we did a thing of, will you ever read this book again? No. Will you ever read this book again? Yeah. So you know, we actually slimmed down our library by a factor of down to 20% of what it was.
So a book clean out, that sounds like that would have been quite fun to be at that garage sale. Anyway, sit back, relax, and allow us to do the work for you. The Conficker worm is a nefarious computer virus that, in its dormant state, has wriggled its way onto millions of Windows PCs around the world. Like a digital STD, it's likely you don't know you've got it as it lies in wait for the perfect moment to rear its ugly head.
It will first scan the internal LAN to find more machines to infect. Then it will start scanning random IP addresses in the public internet. There are black areas it will not scan, areas and IP ranges it will never infect. And we were kind of puzzled about what is it trying to do here? Why there are like 40 or 50 IP ranges it will never touch? Well, they are security companies, certs, antivirus organizations, including us. They, for example, have our IP range. But this is quite unique. The gang behind Downadap has done quite a bit of research.
Mikko Hyppönen of F-Secure at the Species Conference talking about the Conficker virus, or Downadap, as it was known then. For Conficker, the moment that it was meant to destroy the world was supposed to be the 1st of April, April Fool's Day, when remote puppet masters who created the worm turned it on and gained access to, well, everything. But after initial excitable reports, nothing actually happened. So what's next? We've invited Ram Hirkanaidu from Kaspersky Lab to give us a Conficker prognosis. So Ram, tell me what actually was supposed to happen, because I only really gave a very top-level fruity description of what Conficker was supposed to do.
Conficker actually did what it was supposed to do on that day, April the 1st. It was programmed to generate 500 website names out of a possible 50,000 and try to contact them. And it will do that every day. What we've tried to tell people is to actually concentrate not on the date, but to be patched up and to get the Windows updates and also to have good antivirus and update that. Don't focus on the 1st of April.
I know that there are a lot of rumors. Charles and I were talking about this before. Who was it who actually was behind the virus?
Right. At the moment, we're still not sure. Some people said that they did find the people behind it, but that was like an April Fool's joke. So we still do not know who are the people behind this particular Trojan.
And I assume that we're not yet out of the woods.
We're not. From the 1st of April, like I said, it will try to contact websites. It will try 500 out of 50,000. And then on the second day, April the 2nd, it will generate another 500. And then it will do that in subsequent days. So us, as well as other security vendors, are trying very hard to monitor where it's actually going to connect so we can actually try to stop people getting infected from those websites.
So, Ram, I mean, one of the things that has become clear about Configer is that it's an extremely sophisticated piece of programming. And you're talking about, you know, the multiple domains, the random domains that it, or pseudo-random domains it generates. And also, as I understand, there's a lot of encryption built into it. I mean, if someone was setting out to program this now, how big a task would it be?
It's incredibly sophisticated. It's using the very latest encryption techniques. It's using something called MD6 hash, which has only come out end of last year. And there was a flaw in the encryption method. And what they actually did when they found that out very quickly, it actually modified it. As well as the encryption, what they're doing, they're obfuscating the code. What that means actually is that they're scrambling the code that they do. So for us to try and reverse engineer it, it's actually making it much more difficult. And another thing that they've actually introduced in Configure C is peer-to-peer functionality. So it's not only just trying to rely to be a Trojan downloader and downloading updates. It's actually creating a peer-to-peer network that will actually be able to do this itself. And also, it's digitally signing everything. And so it's trying to protect itself from other people that may try to take over the botnet.
Now, peer-to-peer and digital signing were actually fingerprints of the Storm botnet, weren't they?
I do believe so, yes.
So that sort of suggests that the people who are behind this might have had some sort of access to it, or is it that the programming techniques that are being used are either so easy or are so incredibly effective that they've all picked them up?
Configure C has raised the bar in that sense in terms of its sophistication. The peer-to-peer technology, before it used to rely on a command and control center, mm-hmm. So it needs a client and a server. In Configure C, it's both a client and a server in itself. So this has upped the game somewhat.
What's the value of having these many millions of machines? I mean, they have now a gigantic botnet, but isn't it rather difficult to start using that for anything without immediately becoming, you know, being noticed and not in a helpful way to the owners of the botnet?
Exactly. If you try to use the whole of the network, it's such hot property and it's had so much media coverage, then it's unlikely to be that. But what they could try to do is sell part of the bot network or rent that part out to people wanting to, for example, want to send spam messages out or want to do like a denial of service attack on a particular website. All these things, they want to generate money, and that's what it's all about, cybercrime.
What's the sort of pattern of the lives of these botnets? Do they spring up and do they continue, or do they just generally sort of fade away as people update their machines and get better security on the machines? What's the sort of lifespan?
The really large botnets out there, they're not really the ones that we should be concentrating on. There are many others out there that will actually maybe target a specific organization, or they will target 1,000 users, 1,000 PCs, or 5,000 PCs, or 10,000 PCs. What they want to do is to extract information out. If they can stay under the radar of security companies, then the more lease time they have. Once we're onto them, of course, we're able to put updates out there and stop the network. But then they'll try to move on again. It's a constant battle.
What is the best way for PC users to protect themselves? And secondarily, is there a possibility that this could infect other systems as well if they go back and rewrite the software?
What will happen in the future? We don't know yet. The payload could be anything that the people behind it want it to do. The best way, like what we always say, if, for example, if they've got Vista and automatic updates, make sure it's on and properly updated. They, of course, should have good antivirus software or internet security software with good firewall and make sure that is up to date as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That was Ram Hirkanaidu from Kaspersky Lab.
Thank you.
Now, you can read up on all the Configure coverage on guardian.co.uk/technology. But for the moment, here's Jemima with the news.
The Australian government is investing $43 billion Australian revamping its high-speed broadband network through a new private-public partnership. Australia's network has been held back by the cost of installing fibre optic cabling in a vast and inhospitable terrain, but the new project should improve speeds by up to 100 times. IBM's attempt to take over Sun Microsystems for $7 billion has faltered after the two sides failed to agree terms at the weekend. Sun chairman Scott McNeely is rumoured to be pushing for more money, but negotiations prompted IBM to withdraw its offer. The UK's internet service providers are to keep records of their customers' emails and internet phone calls. New government regulations designed to help criminal investigations mean ISPs have to keep details for 12 months, including the date, time, duration and recipients of online communications. After the success of its Twittering Mars Phoenix programme, NASA has persuaded one of its astronauts to tweet. Mike Massimino, or Astro underscore Mike, will be tweeting training updates leading up to his mission on the 12th of May, though there's no word on whether he'll be tweeting from space.
Thanks, Jemima. Charles, now, two things that I know are close to your heart I want to focus on this week. The first is the government's ISP relationship that's just come out today.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the whole idea that the government will be monitoring, it's not going to capture the content of your emails and so on. It's going to be looking at who have you been communicating with. And there's still a bit of a wiggle room in terms of if you're sending a webmail message to someone else who's also on webmail, so it doesn't actually pass through a UK ISP or through their mail servers, then that probably doesn't get followed. I mean, there's a lot of feeling that, you know, why are we being watched in this way? What actually is going to be the benefit of it? And one has to start thinking that, why can't we start with the MPs? I don't know. You know, rather like MPs' expenses or something, you know. If you think it's that kind of idea, okay, well, let's just, you know, let us monitor your traffic in the first place.
Well, I imagine actually they already have, because effectively what it sounds like they're going to be doing is very traditional social network analysis, where they identify and they seek patterns. So, for example, there's a famous example of social network analysis looking at similar kinds of patterns, looking at communication that identified the people who flew into the World Trade Center for the 9/11 attacks. And that was something that was used by the US government and the military to identify those people who were in that group. So I imagine that from the point of view of security, this type of communication, this type of interaction is quite important simply just to have under the radar so that they can identify or pinpoint potential communication loops that they don't want to have going on.
True. Though one has to say, the great thing that didn't happen with the 9/11 hijackers was they didn't identify them before
ahead of time, of course.
Of course. They sort of said afterwards, oh yeah, look at these guys over here. And then, yeah, we're actually, all the information was there available to them through traditional police work. There was the thing of, why are these guys sort of, you know, they're not caring about doing the landing lessons. They want to do the, you know, just the flying bit of it. So one has to question whether it's not, again, one of these things where you look for a technology solution and you forget the fact that actually humans are pretty good at these things, given the right incentives and the right access to human level information. I mean, okay, you could see that after the fact it might be useful for picking up other people who might be connected with the terrorist network. But one has to, you know, one always has to wonder about this. Still, at least it's not the data, which, you know, which I think would get people even more worked up.
Well, it's interesting that they're focusing on internet traffic and not, for example, on telephone traffic or anything else. So this could potentially,
telephone traffic is already
being done. So this is just completing the set, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. It's Britain Book.
Gosh, that is a bit dark.
Jackie Smith recommended you should be a friend of.
Awesome. She's my friend on Twitter. No, she's not. Anyway, let's move on. The other thing I wanted to focus on was something that a listener commented on a couple of weeks ago about your very prescient 2009 prediction that Sun would be purchased by a major player, or rather that it would go bust. And of course, very, very recently, IBM made moves. It looked like they were going to cuddle up with Sun, but that's now disappeared. Now, what's going on there?
The rumor was first that IBM and Sun were in talks for a purchase. One of the early rumors was that IBM might buy Sun for $6.5 billion in cash only. Then it was $9 billion, but of cash and shares. Sun's shares ramped up on the news because it had been tootling around about $3 billion market cap. But then this weekend, we heard that the board is split and that the deal is off. What I've been hearing lately is that Scott McNeely, who's the chairman of Sun, didn't like the deal, whereas Jonathan Schwartz, who's the chief executive, did like the deal. If it's a case that Scott McNeely was the one who prevailed in this and that he either didn't like the deal or he didn't like the price, then one has to wonder if Jonathan Schwartz is going to have much longer at Sun, which will... I don't know. I'm not sure if Sun can bear much more. You know, people leaving through the exit doors. But one has to say that it did look for a while, and it's not dead yet because hell, we don't even know if it was on in the first place. But it does look like the sort of thing that I think Sun would have benefited from it more than it would have lost.
And is this going to be this year's ICANN Yahoo Microsoft spinning out of control news story that we comment on for the next 7 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, given that the last year we were talking about sort of $44 billion, it was like something out of, you know, Mini Me. But this year we're talking about $6 billion. You know, it shows how far we've fallen, doesn't it?
Yeah, not as much nefariousness there. Well, you can read up on all these stories and the latest headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now for a short commercial break.
This month, Cosmopolitan comes face to face with the real David Bowie and spotlights the brilliant fashions that will light up your summer nights. We get to the heart of sexual jealousy and give you a chance to win this fabulous Nissan Pulsar. December Cosmopolitan wraps up dozens of dazzling Christmas gift ideas and shows you ways to keep your sex life sizzling. December Cosmopolitan, out and about now.
Well, a few weeks ago, we suggested that women lack the confidence to promote themselves as technologists. The reason, we argued, was because women don't see themselves as technology consumers. Well, our next guest is working with two bastions of US and UK female-centered offline media, Cosmo and Good Housekeeping, and is working on bringing more of their readers into the digital world. Sophia Stewart is director of mobile at Hearst Publishing, and she makes it her business to convert print readership into technology consumers. As well as being a strong proponent of ebooks, which Hearst has recently announced is a market that they plan to get into, she's keen to spread the good word about digital content. And there are some very gendered titles in their portfolio, from Cosmo to Esquire. And the mobile solutions that she delivers use different techniques to win over audiences. So from her research, it appeared that women are more solution-oriented, so they want content delivered rather than to be entertained. But is this a case across the board? I began by asking Sophia whether age stereotypes are true. Are the younger Cosmo readers tech-savvy and the Good Housekeeping readers tech-resistant?
When I first came to the States and started to work in technology, everyone assumed that I should just be doing technology for teens and young women. And I said, you have to be kidding. We have 26 million readers of Good Housekeeping magazine in the US, and they all have specific needs that we can meet on the go through mobile. So they're not technophobes at all. In fact, they don't need to have any technical knowledge, and women prefer technology to be very transparent. They're not that interested in the how it works. They just want to know it works.
And thinking specifically about the Cosmo readers, are you trying to take them to places, technological places, that they haven't been before?
We're just trying to establish a comfort with emerging technology, and we do that through taking content that they already know and love and use and then putting it on the mobile device. So, for example, for Cosmo, when I first sat down with the editor-in-chief, Kate White, of Cosmopolitan, a couple of years ago now, and I said, what are the issues that a woman in her early 20s, mid-20s in the U.S., what are the big issues that she has, and what content do you have that she would need from us on the go on her mobile phone? And she looked at me and she said, we have a dude decoder. And I thought this was possibly the oddest moment I had in my emerging technology career, but I went with it. And I said, what is this dude decoder? And she said, it's a male body language decoder, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's sort of psych 101, if you like. So we have all the pictures of the chaps, attractive, not usually wearing a top. This is Cosmo. And then there's a definition of what they're doing, if they raise their left eyebrow or certain behavior that they do. And then Cosmo has the entire definition of what that means. And we put this entire database on the mobile. And then when we promoted that in the magazine, we got a huge spike in usage because women said, oh, that's useful. I need a body language decoder. So that's one example.
And what about for the opposite end of the spectrum? You mentioned things like recipes and stuff for the Good Housekeeping crew. What other dude decoder style things have you got for that crew?
There are all the recipes, which are so simple. You can be in a store and you can be looking at the produce that's there and you can think, well, I really want to, you know, cook more fish, but I don't know any fish recipes. Well, in your hand there, we have about 50 to 60 fish recipes. Ask Heloise is a very big part of Good Housekeeping. You know, women have sort of a couple of thousand questions in their head every single day, and so we wanted to be able to answer that on the mobile site. You know, grouting that isn't working properly, or how do I fix the coffee maker when it's broken.
It sounds as if the content that you've created, you mentioned before that it's service content. It's very much people go there. It's almost as if it's a destination. Is there any opportunity for people to contribute, or is it very much a one-way conversation?
No, it's very much a two-way conversation, although I will say that especially for the women over 35, it's much more solution-orientated. She has a question, she just wants the answer. But for the chaps on Esquire, we do get a huge amount of feedback. We have taken the best bars in America is something that Esquire has been running for many years. So we took that entire database, made all the phone numbers live, click to call, get the directions, get the story behind the bar, you know, why it's great to be in Chicago at this particular bar. So it feeds into each other.
I know you guys did some human-computer interaction, some HCI work as well. I'm wondering if there were any differences, sort of gender or demographic or age types of differences about how people use mobile content that's different from how they might use a traditional website.
We looked at how people like to consume content on the go, and we took in the three main ways that people feel comfortable consuming content. People are either they want to drill down through category headings, they want us to hold their hand, if you like, through the content, so we have that and the way that the user interface is set up. Then we also have it be fully searchable, so you can just type into a search box, you can get anything you want from within the mobile site. Or some people are very linear, so we've also created all of the tips can be viewed on a next or previous. You can just click through the site and consume the site in that way. So having studied a lot of human-computer interaction, we wanted to make sure those three ways of consuming content were fully addressed.
Have you found any, and this is really deterministic, but have you found any gender differences there or any age differences?
Yes. Often if someone is older and they haven't used it before, they need to feel that the content's familiar to them, which is why we've used Ask Heloise and Peggy Post. But those people are much more likely to spend actually more time just going through the site, looking at the tips, getting familiar with it. Whereas people who are maybe under 30 or under 25 on maybe m.17.com, we notice they know what they want, they type it into the search field, they go to the tip, and then they get out. So they're very much more directional.
That was Sophia Stewart, Director of Mobile at Hearst Publishing. Charles, tell me what you know about mobile content. Do you have any particular content outlets that you think, yes, they've really got it, they know how to do it?
I think it's still an emergent market. I mean, the problem has been that you haven't had mobile devices that have been really good for reading content. I mean, the BlackBerry was about the best one for some time, and then the iPhone came along and really changed the game. So you've now got 13 million iPhones, I think it is, and growing all the time, which are in effect really effective mobile browsers, which give you near enough the real internet there on your phone. And it's a tolerable browsing experience if the network is fast enough. But in terms of people able to offer mobile content that you can really get down and dirty with, I think the problem has been that there's been not enough devices to read it on. So it's been an emergent market for ages.
Well, speaking of the iPhone, at the past couple of weeks, I've been at two conferences. I was at South by Southwest and at GDC. And it seemed to me that everybody and their uncle was rushing to the iPhone. And a lot of what's happening is that people are literally throwing their apps at the App Store and just saying, brilliant, now that we've done this, we're going to be millionaires. And so we're seeing an absolute gold rush, but we're seeing a whole lot of mire and very few things rising to the top. And as Sophia was saying, it's the brands. It's the brands that attract those new users. How is it that new brands can rise to the top of some of these applications?
Wow, if I knew that, I think I'd be a really rich mobile consultant, actually. But to unpack it a bit, I mean, why is it that people are doing all these things on the iPhone? Well, they're doing it on the iPhone rather than, say, the BlackBerry or even Windows Mobile. Apple's got this app store, which is very tightly controlled, where you can't get those apps except by going through the app store. And you have to pay money for them if people choose that you pay money for them. So, you know, the piracy problem is really tiny. And that means, especially with the new version of the iPhone software that's coming out, people will be able to do subscriptions within the application. And, you know, to me, that just rings all sorts of bells.
Well, if you've got something to say about this, or if you want to pay Charles for his mobile content consultancy...
we have reasonable rates.
then add to the conversation at guardian.co.uk/technology, or head back to our archives to listen to the interview that inspired this entire interview. So check it out at guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
Coming to an MP3 player near you soon. Hi, I'm Jeff Jarvis with details of The Guardian's latest podcast, Media Talk USA. It's like our regular Media Talk program, only American. Less wit, less irony. Our pilot episode is available right now, which includes the founder of the Huffington Post website on how she's planning to save journalism. And as the tumbleweed blows through the printing presses this side of the Atlantic, we ask whether President Obama's passionate embrace of new media is his way of controlling it.
Ann Compton.
Hey, Ann.
You sound surprised.
I am surprised.
Elizabeth Holmes of the Wall Street Journal and Jay Rosen of New York University are on the panel. We'll be doing this every month, so take the hard work out of remembering and subscribe. iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter, you know the drill. For everything you need to know, go to guardian.co.uk/MediaTalkUSA.
Media Talk USA from The Guardian and paid content.
It's been a busy week for the bloggers, and this is what you've had to say in response. Charles, what's happening on technology?
Oh, well, it's all been around, you know, our good friend Configure again. I have to say the one that that I liked was Opiatus. And the thing was that we had a blog story news thing, which was about Configure could be a deadly threat, or it could be an April Fool's joke, all revolving around the sort of April 1 timing. And it degenerated, as these things often do, into, yeah, well, Windows gets viruses and Macs don't, and you know, my Linux one's never had a virus either, and you know, a sort of a three-way Mexican hate-off, basically. But so Opiatus said, oh gosh, a Mac versus PC thread. I'll archive it for its rarity value. But then had the useful sort of input, which is it's mostly about educating people to use their computers properly. If people are on Windows, most viruses are head of their way. Tell your Windows friends what to do. If you're running Mac and you're running as an admin, that's stupid. You're leaving the door unlocked and wide open. Even the diehard Mac heads say so. Unix users will never do it. It's the biggest hole. And if you've got Linux, no idea. I should probably know what to warn Linux users about, but I don't. And I think, hey, a commenter who can say that, who can say, I don't know what to tell you, that's quality commenting.
That is, isn't it? That's taking control of their fate, isn't it? Well, funnily enough, we've got some Configure comments via Twitter. Phil Turpin says, very similar to the commentators who were on the tech blog, he says, without wishing to sound smug, as an Ubuntu user, it was all quite amusing. And Tombot18 was also similarly smug, as he's a Mac user. Mm-hmm. If you want to comment on what we're covering every week, then do keep your eyes on @GuardianTW on Twitter. Every Monday afternoon, we send out a question and then we parse it and we pull it into the program. But over on the games blog, Greg, one of the bloggers, made a comment on the PS3 firmware and why FIFA 09 could be a collector's edition on the South Coast. And he was rather upset that one of his football teams is now no longer going to be included in FIFA 09.
Duh.
I know. And I have to admit, most of that completely passed me by because, like Mark Kermode, I know nothing about football.
I know less.
Oh, no. Well, then my next question was for you, Charles. Johnny Moomin.
Southampton is Pompey. I do know that.
Okay, good. We're there. No, Scott just said it's not. Scott, the producer, just said it's not. It will all become clear in just a second.
There you go.
Johnny Moomin, who will have to comment on this comment, just to keep us all straight. He says, Johnny Moomin says, the irony is that Pompey's best team is in this year's FIFA, or it was until the blasted Adidas Live season got rid of Diarra and Defoe. I still remember with joy when Pompey first got into PES PES, that would be Pro Evolution Soccer, as South Coast Blue or some other nonsense. I have absolutely no idea what I just said. If you can, if anybody out there could
yeah, we're going to ring down to Sport and get them to send someone up.
Right. Well, Scott tells us that he was happy when Portsmouth got into Pro Evo. I'm glad that somebody in the room understands. But then again, this is the technology podcast.
And Johnny Moomin, couldn't you have just said that?
Meanwhile, on other feedback options, we've hit 816 followers on our Facebook group, I Love the Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast, and I promise to do the podcast in 3 different languages if we can get it up to 1,000. I was thinking about saying that I'd do it naked, but
is
now that
English,
we're in...
English, US, English, UK, and Australian?
Pretty much. But our studio is basically a giant glass fishbowl, and we've got a picture of it up on our Flickr pool, so I'm not going to be doing it naked. I will be doing it in 3 different languages, so given that I have a tenuous grip on English, that should be very interesting. So go on, give me a challenge, get us up to 1,000 people on our Facebook group, and who knows what will come out. You can follow us on all these places and keep up on the latest at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much to our guests, Sophia and Ram, and thanks as well to Charles. Charles, what do you have planned for the bank holiday this week?
Well, I'm going to be in France, completely cut off from the interwebs and all that sort of stuff.
How will you survive?
Very well, actually. I did it for 2 weeks last year. It's not a problem at all.
My Mac's hard drive died when I was in San Francisco for the GDC conference, and
I left my hard drive in San Francisco.
Seriously, it was really painful. I had to hand it over to the genius behind the Genius Bar at the Apple Store. Literally, I think he could see I was slightly panicking because
I left the heart of my computer in San Francisco.
I did. He's like, "Go to the beach. Go do something." I was like, "I can't." Anyway, truly an addict, I will be spending the bank holiday weekend sitting in front of my computer writing my PhD. It will be done in August. You have my word. Anyway, next week we're back with another startup surgery. Are you thinking about going into the digital content business yourself and need some funds? Well, send in your questions to our VC expert via Twitter with the #StartupSurgery, all one word, that's Startup Surgery, or add them to the comment trail on PDA and we will pose them for you. Have a great weekend. See you next Tuesday.